Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, award-winning writer Elliot Kleinberg has a new historical novel called Hypocrite's Row.
When you're not looking, you're learning about history. You're enjoying this really good book, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I just learned about history.
We'll discuss a pivotal year in Florida history as identified by historian Jesus Mendez.
In his interpretation of events, 1892 emerges as the critical year when the multidimensional interests came together to establish a new trajectory for Florida.
And we'll talk about William Henry Dahl's geological expeditions in Florida. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Elliot Kleinberg will be presented with the Patrick Smith Award for his novel Peace River at the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum, being held May 28th through 30th at the Shores Resort and Spa in Daytona. At that conference, Kleinberg will also be participating in the panel discussion Florida History as Fiction, a discussion with award-winning authors. Elliot Kleinberg has a new novel called Hypocrite's Row, focusing on a Miami detective in the 1920s when Prohibition made alcohol illegal.
We talked in the past over the years, and of course it's been a common subject in historical society meetings, about the amazing time when Prohibition really was not enforced at all in Florida. It was really just a joke. Miami historian Paul George likes to say that Florida was the leakiest place in the country. And what I like to tell people is that, you know, everybody knows about the great drug wars of the 80s, 70s, 80s, like in South Florida, the cocaine wars. But really, they had nothing on what was going on here in the 20s, because what I try to explain to people is that not everyone did drugs. And even the people who did drugs had no illusions about who they were buying those drugs from. They were not buying them from nice people. And in Prohibition, a lot of people drank. Very many people drank. And so they came to look at the guys who were supplying them their liquor, and liquor had been taken away from them. You know, drugs were illegal the whole time, but alcohol had been legal, and then all of a sudden it wasn't. And so the people who were supplying the liquor became sort of their heroes, their anti-heroes, their folk heroes. And the law enforcement people who were trying to enforce what even they would admit was an unpopular law became the bad guys, the thugs.
Even though the manufacture, transportation, and sale of alcohol was illegal in 1920s Florida, there was no shortage of bars called speakeasies that catered to drinkers.
There were speakeasies everywhere. And the people who ran the speakeasies were pretty smart. And so they'd have lookouts. And, you know, somebody would rat and say, oh, the cops are on their way. And all of a sudden the cops would get there and all the liquor had been replaced by lemonade and, you know, sandwiches. And anybody important had been rushed out the back door. So even if they did catch people, they paid a fine. The liquor got poured down the drain. That was the cost of doing business. That was a business expense. And, of course, in West Palm Beach, in Palm Beach, the Royal Poinciana, the famous Royal Poinciana Hotel, had a secret room where the well-connected could go and drink without being hassled. And that room was called Hypocrite's Row. And that's the name of the book.
While the novel Hypocrite's Row is based on actual events in Florida history, there are some elements, including the detective Nate Moran, that are products of the author's imagination. Elliot Kleinberg.
I invented Nate Moran. He's a 1920s Miami police detective. I didn't want to follow the cliches of a hard-boiled private eye, 10 times divorced, drunk, you know. So Nate, you know, Nate joins the police force like everybody else. He falls in love with his sweetheart. He has three kids. He doesn't drink. He doesn't smoke. He chews candy cigarettes instead of smoking, which gets funny looks from some of the people who he's interviewing. I didn't want him to fit the stereotypes of, you know, roaring 20s, gangsters and stuff like that. Now, what a lot of people, you know, a lot of people know about the gangsters of Chicago and, you know, Al Capone and all that. A lot of them were in South Florida at one time or another. And so South Florida was just as wild as Chicago was, as New York was. It was a smaller town. But even though it was small, a lot of big things were happening. A lot of liquor was passing through. A lot of famous people came through. A lot of celebrities came through. And there was a lot of really scary stuff going on as law enforcement tried to enforce a very unpopular law.
Some novels romanticize criminals, particularly 1920s gangsters, but Hypocrite's Row is a noir novel that does not glamorize the era.
People go back and they look at these roaring 20s and they're very intrigued. It's very romantic. But, you know, there was nothing romantic about a policeman being shot in the face and leaving behind a wife and daughter. There's nothing romantic about moonshiners cutting their moonshine with wood alcohol to make it go farther and not being very scientific about it. And some of their customers end up dead. There's nothing romantic about police officers or elected officials who have betrayed their trust and you don't know who to trust. There's certainly nothing romantic or idyllic about that.
Florida-based writer Michael Connelly has produced an extensive series of books featuring L.A. detective Harry Bosch. Elliot Kleinberg is focusing on his Miami detective, Nate Moran, in multiple novels as well.
First of all, let me declare up front, I'm no Michael Connelly. I know Michael Connelly. He's an amazing, prolific writer. Having said that, there already are four Nate Moran novels in the can, so to speak. And they are set to come out every year around February. The first one, Hypocrite's Row, is pretty much themed on Prohibition. The second one, which will come out in 2027, is called The Treasure of Indian Key. And that focuses mostly on the land boom. The third one is called The Wreck of the Peter Carey. And that one pretty much focuses on the end of the boom and the hard crash that followed. Because, of course, in Florida, so much of Florida's success was based on a house of cards that when everything crashed, it crashed harder in Florida than just about anywhere else. And then the fourth book, Midnight Pass, brings us up to Florida at the beginning of World War II.
During his more than three-decade career as a newspaper journalist, Elliot Kleinberg wrote several nonfiction books, including Black Cloud, The Deadly Hurricane of 1928. Although he is now concentrating on novels, his heart is still with history. Kleinberg includes a bibliography at the end of each novel to separate fact from fiction.
When I retired from the newspaper, you know, I could pretty much do whatever I wanted, and I had always wanted to play around with fiction. But what I did is I did historical fiction, because historical fiction is a very sneaky thing. When you're not looking, you're learning about history. You're enjoying this really good book, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I just learned about history.
Elliot Kleinberg's new novel, Hypocrite's Row, is set in 1920s Prohibition-era Florida. His first novel, Peace River, set during the Civil War, has earned the Patrick Smith Award, which will be presented during the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum, May 28th through 30th in Daytona. Kleinberg will also participate in a panel discussion on Florida history and fiction at the conference. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to find out about upcoming events, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, historians seldom write histories on a single year, although there are some years that stand out as pivotal. Examples include 1861, 1914, and 1968. Jesus Mendez, an associate professor at Barry University in Miami, who was researching transportation links between the Caribbean and Florida, recognized the importance of the year 1892 to the state's economic and transportation future. His article appeared in the summer 2009 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly.
Mendez focuses attention on Henry Flagler and Henry Plant and their cooperative competitiveness to analyze both their friendship and their competitive business rivalry over the creation of winter tourist resorts, expansive rail and shipping development, and enhancing the connections between the Caribbean and Florida that heralded a new market role for the Sunshine State. In his interpretation of events, 1892 emerges as the critical year when the multidimensional interests came together to establish a new trajectory for Florida. Henry Flagler's interest in Florida began with a visit to Jacksonville in 1878. Over the next 7 years, Flagler experienced what we might call a midlife crisis, as both his personal and business life underwent profound changes. The death of his first wife and remarriage, creation and investigation of the Standard Oil Trust, and political pushback against his involvement in the 1884 presidential campaign of James G. Blaine. Together, these events encouraged Flagler to seek a new direction. An 1885 visit to St. Augustine, quote, launched his initial phase of activities in Florida, determined to make the city the new port of the South, end quote. In short order, he acquired land in St. Augustine, completed the construction of the Ponce de Leon Hotel, initiated plans for the Alcazar Hotel, supported the construction of public works and infrastructure projects, and secured adequate land transportation links between Jacksonville and St. Augustine through the acquisition of the Jacksonville, St. Augustine, and Halifax rail line. The latter action proved to be the beginning of a series of acquisitions and consolidations of short line railroads that became known as the Flagler Syndicate. Flagler's vision intersected with that of Henry Plant and Hamilton Diston in the 1880s.
Connie, Flagler, Plant, Diston, and a third Henry, Henry Sanford, envisioned and built a modern Florida.
Indeed they did, though we may debate the ramification of those visions. They all acted within a larger national and international context in which the geopolitical value of the Caribbean and Gulf nations were central in the emerging international economy. The movement of freight by rail and ship especially interested Henry Plant, and in 1881, discussions on the potential for a Central American canal in Nicaragua and a Pan-American railroad could not have escaped his attention as he moved his operations into Florida. As Mendez notes, quote, with the establishment of the Plant Investment Company, PICO, in 1882 to coordinate railroad investments, Plant secured the future of his Southern Express Company, just like Flagler, with his purchase of the Jacksonville, St. Augustine, and Halifax Railway, secured the future of his planned winter resort development in St. Augustine, end quote. With the sale of 4 million acres of South Florida land to Philadelphia industrialist Hamilton Diston in 1881, Plant expanded his activities by organizing the Savannah, Florida, and Western Railway Company, acquiring 60% of the South Florida Railway Company in 1883, and securing a through route from Kissimmee to Tampa. In 1886, he formed the Plant Steamship Company and secured the U.S. mail contract to Cuba. In 1888, he completed a deep water rail and sea terminal at Port Tampa. The cordial rivalry between Plant and Flagler was on full display as they met several times over the course of 1890-1891. It was becoming increasingly clear that a canal would be built in either Nicaragua or Panama, and with its completion, quote, an enormous trade would come to the United States from Central and South America, which would seek the nearest deep water port, Key West, end quote. In 1892, Flagler and Plant began consolidating their preparation of future shipping success. In January, an undersea telegraph cable between Nassau and Jupiter was completed. In April, Flagler and Plant met to discuss the advisability of extending the East Coast rail line from Daytona to Sanford in order to bypass the Jacksonville, Tampa, and Key West Railroad and create a seamless connection with Plant's South Florida Railroad. In May, Flagler began surveys to extend the Jacksonville, St. Augustine, and Halifax Railroad, an initiation of the process that would extend to Key West. That same month, Flagler incorporated the Florida Coast and Gulf Railway Company that connected Jacksonville and Tampa. In June, the New York Times, quote, went public with a well-authenticated rumor of an alliance between Flagler and Plant, which will freeze out several Florida lines or compel them to construct new outlets for business, end quote. In August, the president of the South Florida Railroad suggested that a rail line to Key West was, quote, not impracticable, just a matter of money. Thus, by the end of 1892, the mechanisms for consolidating Florida's short-line railways into larger systems that ran up and down the east and west coast and intersected in the so-called hinterlands was fully in place. The vision for the overseas railway to Key West was indeed just a matter of money.
And of course, Flagler realized his dream of the overseas railway to Key West in 1912, just a year before he died. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Elgar's Serenade for Strings in E minor, Opus 20, performed here by the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, was composed in 1892, the year we've been discussing. This is Florida Frontiers. In the late 1800s, William Henry Dahl came to Florida four times, and as Sebastian Garcia reports, he increased our understanding of the geology of our state.
Carl Miller is an independent scholar whose research focuses on American naturalist William Healy Dahl.
William Healy Dahl was an American naturalist. He lived from 1845 to 1927, and he really worked in a lot of different fields. He was involved with oceanography, geography, geology, even archaeology and in linguistics, but he was especially known for his work in invertebrate zoology and invertebrate paleontology with respect to Florida, in other words, fossilized shells. He spent a lot of time in Alaska in his career, and that's what he's principally known for today. But he also spent a significant amount of time in Florida, and through his expeditions and analysis of Florida fossils helped develop our understanding of how the peninsula came to be.
The scientific study of Earth's ancient life through the analysis of fossils, known as paleontology, emerged in the 19th century, when individuals like Dahl began to observe and categorize specific fossil groupings of species based on their ground level within the Earth. Florida's unique geography, as a peninsula projecting from the rest of the North American continent, attracted the interest of several paleontologists during this time, including Dahl.
Florida began to get a lot of attention from paleontologists. They were curious about the background of Florida. It jutted out, obviously, from the rest of North America into the Gulf and the Atlantic, and they wondered if it had the same background as the rest of the continent or if it was something different. For example, Louis Agassiz, the man that taught Dahl, felt that Florida was different than the rest of the continent, and it had been formed by long-term deposits of coral. Another thing that intrigued paleontologists was that there were reports of abundant fossils that were unique, that were just, in some places, just laying on the ground. So in 1885, the Smithsonian had Dahl make his first trip to Florida. So Dahl spent the month of April 1885 investigating deposits of vertebrate fossils. He found mastodon, rhinoceros, and llama. He also found a native mound that was being taken apart to be used as fertilizer for a local orange grove. But being a scientist, he described the remains in the exposed mound. There were shells, marl, animal bones, and human remains. Then he returned to Washington to catalog and write on what he had found. And that was his first visit to Florida.
Dahl returned to Florida for a second time in 1887 to investigate the strata of Southwest Florida. His findings from this second trip corrected previous assertions about Florida's geological past.
His journal began on February 12, 1887, with a notation that he purchased about 100 specimens of fossils from a local collector. Then the following day, he took a train to Orient Station and explored the stream at Six Mile Run, which had cut through limestone, leaving 12-foot-high banks, which he examined for fossils. He found some evidence of shells that he judged to be from the Miocene era, which today we know was basically 23 million years ago up to 5 million years ago. After visiting with another local collector on February 14th and examining more Miocene shell fossils found near Tampa, Dahl spent much of the next few days in Sarasota. On February 17th, at Little Sarasota Bay, he found internal casts of various fossils, which he dated as being older than the post-Pliocene estimate of earlier visitors to the area. And that was about 5.3 million to 2 million years ago. So when he got back to Washington, he discussed the significance of his findings. The strata of Southwest Florida, according to Dahl, began with a sandy layer that was derived from the wearing of limestone rocks beneath it. Fossil remains show the strata, or the layers below the sand, varied in different parts of the state. The hypothetical southward extension of the Oligocene on most recent geologic maps now seems erroneous. And the Oligocene was a period from 34 million years ago to 23 million years ago. Aside from concluding that much of southern Florida was younger than the northern part of the state, Dahl noticed that the fossils he found near Tampa were chiefly marine, but there's a certain mix with land shells that becomes more pronounced toward the top of the limestone. To him, that indicated a gradual increase of the adjacent land during the deposition of the bed of the fossils. He concluded by stating that no coral rock or coral reef formation was observed in the Tampa area fossils, and therefore said that the idea that Florida was created by coral deposits could not have been correct, and it really was more like the rest of North America.
A third trip to Florida in 1891 allowed Dahl to further his findings about the geologic origins of Florida.
This time he made a quick visit to Peace Creek. He discussed the geologic origins of Florida overall, noting that the survey of the ocean floor showed an immense triangular plateau which united Florida, the Bahamas, and Cuba, concluding that there was little room for doubt that the mass of this great platform was laid down during the later Eocene, which was 56 million years ago to about 34 million years ago. By his evaluation of fossils at different locations in the state, Dahl found that the deposition of other than older Miocene was accompanied by an increase in the area of the land and probably was very slow and gently elevated, followed by an equally gentle and probably moderate depression. While prehistoric Florida was separate from the rest of North America during that time, by the late Pliocene, the permanent connection of the peninsula with the continent was accomplished.
Dahl ventured to Florida for a fourth and final time in 1893 to analyze the geologic origins of the bluffs along the Apalachicola River in the Panhandle. Dahl synthesized his research findings from his four Florida trips into a six-volume book titled Contributions to the Tertiary Fauna of Florida. This work remains a foundational text for understanding Florida's ancient life.
He used all of this research that he did in the field, and he did what is his signature work on the state, which is a six-volume work called Contributions to the Tertiary Fauna of Florida. And he worked on that from 1890 to 1903, and it's 1,654 pages with descriptions and illustrations of hundreds upon hundreds of fossilized species, mostly shells, and was very well regarded by other scientists. Several decades after he had died, extinction theory started to arise in the scientific community. And this was the idea that the boundaries between different geologic periods were not gradual, but were relatively in geologic terms. There were sudden drops in species from one time period to the next. So shells, since they were hard and had a lot of detail to them, proved to be ideal trackers. So different scientists used his work to go through the record of fossils that had been found and come up with support for this hypothesis that there had been abrupt changes between periods.
Although an obscured figure today, William Dahl left a significant impact across a wide variety of scientific fields, especially through his work in Florida.
His work helped clarify the geologic history of the peninsula. Again, there were different theories about how Florida came to be, but his work really made a lot of progress in our understanding of how Florida became the peninsula that we live on today. His meticulous recording of thousands of species provided the data that was needed for the development of extinction theory, which also touches on our state.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and find us anytime at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.